Hello, and welcome on board for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. There are a few options to subscribe to the podcast: iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. There's also the Turkey Book Talk Facebook page, which you can search for, and the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Following those will help keep you up to date with the latest episodes, or you can always just subscribe at my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Keep in mind that you can rate or review this podcast on whatever app you use, which helps flag up Turkey Book Talk for other potential listeners who may not yet know about it. And remember, if you enjoy or benefit in some way from this podcast and you want to support it and me, you can do so directly via my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. You can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now let's get cracking with this latest episode, in which I speak to Hale Yilmaz, an associate professor at Southern Illinois University, about her book, Becoming Turkish: Nationalist Reforms and Cultural Negotiations in Early Republican Turkey, 1923-1945. It was published in English by Syracuse University Press and is also due to be published in Turkey, in Turkish, later this year by Istanbul Bilgi University Press, so keep your eyes peeled for that. The book examines how the Kemalist reforms of the early Turkish Republic were passed, their deeper roots in the Ottoman Empire, and the varied reception to them across the country, where the reality was often far more ambiguous than the black and white picture typically portrayed. We discuss that in our conversation, as well as the broader question of state social engineering by governments in Turkey up to today, but I started by asking Hale Yilmaz to outline the argument she makes in her book.
As you just explained, there are two major arguments. One is that there was this passive general submission, and on the other extreme, there was violent rebellion, revolt, and resistance, especially in the East. So what I've been interested in is what happened to the reforms, once they were passed in Ankara. So I was interested in the social life of the reforms beyond those moments of rebellion and violent resistance. As you say, there was this gray area. So I look at the various forms of acceptance, negotiation, the everyday forms of resistance. And I also wanted to move from the center, from the big cities to the provinces, to Anatolia, small towns and villages. How did ordinary people in their everyday lives experience this process of reforms, this period? Initially, I actually wanted to do a micro history of the province of Trabzon. So I was going to look at this question in the context of one specific province. And I went to Trabzon in 2002. And during the course of the research, the project got shifted, got transformed from a focus on a particular province to a macro history that focused on a small number of specific themes or topics, case studies. And so I ended up focusing on the clothing reforms for men and women. I treated those differently. And I also looked at language, specifically the alphabet reform. And I looked at the culture of national celebrations.
And one of the things that you specifically talk about is the hat law of 1925. And this is a kind of famous law that people refer to these days that introduced the use of Western style hats instead of the fez. And it outlawed traditional religious headgear worn in civilian life. Could you just outline why this was kind of an important and symbolic law in this Kemalist reform era?
Yes. As you say, it was very much a symbolic law, but it did have everyday consequences. The hat law, the adoption of the European-style hat, it was about getting rid of the fez and other forms of headgear, other forms of hats that were associated with either religion or the Ottoman period or different ethnicities, different groups. So the Hat Law was intended to be part of this westernizing process, that the Turkish men should wear hats, the style, type of hats that European men wear. So that's some of it. But it was also getting rid of different styles of hats that symbolize different competing identities, whether it's Islamic identity or Kurdish ethnic identity, and so on. So it was both intended to be unifying, nationalizing, but also westernizing. In this period, Turkish reformers, this is true for Iranians and quite a few others as well, they were so obsessed with appearances. They were so worried about appearances, and in large part because they were worried about European perceptions of them, of Turks, Iranians, Arabs, as Orientals, as backward. And these reformers wanted to do things to show that they were not different from the Europeans, that they were trying, by getting rid of the fez, they were really trying to erase a sign of being Oriental, being Islamic, being Eastern.
And one of the great ironies is that the Hat Law was targeting the fez and people wearing the fez because, of course, the reformers around Ataturk saw the fez as this very backward symbol of the old Ottoman order. But the irony is that basically, 100 years before, the fez was introduced and encouraged in the 19th century. And at the time when it was introduced, it was itself seen as this modern westernizing innovation against the traditional religious Islamic turban. It's kind of a delicious irony.
Yes, the fez was introduced in the 1820s. So it had been around only for a century. So it really was not this old tradition, going back centuries, this Islamic headgear that's always been there since the time of Muhammad or anything like that. It was relatively new, but successful. So in the 1925, late 1920s, then many people defended the fez in the name of tradition and in the name of Islam, but it really was relatively new. But from the point of view of the reformers, they felt they had to leave it behind, exactly because the fez had been successful as an Ottoman headgear, and they were trying to remove everything that was associated with the old era, with the Ottoman period. But one thing that I emphasize in the book is that it really was not only about the fez, that they tried to get rid of different kinds of headgear. So the fez was only one of these. And it was successful. In a way, it was successful. But that doesn't mean everybody voluntarily accepted it. And I do give example stories of, various forms of everyday forms of resistance, especially with the elderly men, how they would seclude themselves in their homes, refuse to go out because they didn't want to put on a hat, and they couldn't really wear the fez because then the policemen or the gendarmes intervened. So there was that period. There was that period of change, but eventually the fez really disappeared. So it is supposed to be this unifying measure. But one result of the hat reform was that the new hat or the new hats, it leads to a kind of a class distinction. So there is the round European style hat that's for more upper middle class, upper class men. But when you look at peasants and workers and poor people, they were wearing the cap. So even though this was supposed to be unifying, the result is really at least two forms of headgear revealing class distinctions.
Now, one of the really important things to note is that a lot of these reforms were being passed at a time when around 90% of the population was still illiterate. And two of the other things that you explore are education and the language reforms and the script reforms from the Ottoman script to the Latin script, and also the celebration of new national holidays, often based on the War of Independence after the First World War. Could you just talk a bit about the importance of these changes?
Yes. The national holidays or celebrations, in terms of Turkish historiography, Turkish historians had not really looked at them closely, because they're usually not included in the sphere of reforms, because with reforms, usually historians were thinking more political reforms. And the national holidays were seen more in the sphere of culture and ethnography, and here in the book I argued that the celebrations were very much part of this process of nation making, modernizing, nationalizing process. So in the 1920s, 30s, we see the emergence of a number of new national days: the Youth and Sports Day, Children's and National Sovereignty, perhaps most important of all, the Republic Day, celebrating the proclamation of the Republic. So with these holidays, one, they were all associated with the new state, the new regime, accomplishments or ideals of the new regime, but at the same time, they often dealt with a real issue, a social problem as well. In the case of the 23 April National Sovereignty and Children's Day, well, it's on the one hand celebrating national sovereignty. On the other hand, it was intended to draw attention to the child problem, the child hunger, child health problems. Well, one thing to remember, of course, is the 1920s, 30s. This is a period after an entire decade of war and destruction. So there were many, many social problems. And some of the national holidays were really connected with some of these social issues. So yes, there was symbolic value in them, but they were also intended to draw attention to the many social issues of the time. And in terms of it, you know, when they added the new holidays, they terminated those holidays that were closely associated with the Ottoman regime, with the Ottoman state. But the new holidays, the Children's Day, for example, had their origins in the late Ottoman period, in the Young Turk period. And in that way, they were not entirely new. Like so many other reforms, this is true, definitely true for the language reform. There was an Ottoman background, Ottoman context to them. Another point with the national holidays is that the creation of the new holidays did not mean getting rid of religious holidays. So Turkish citizens continued to celebrate religious days, the important Islamic days, the two major ones being the celebration at the end of Ramadan and the sacrifice holiday. So unlike in the Soviet experience, in the Turkish case, we do see the creation of a culture of secular national holidays did not end the culture of religious holidays, religious celebrations.
Another thing that feeds into your argument, I think, is that, you know, we tend to imagine the reform process as this kind of homogenous thing that was completely dominant everywhere in the country. But as your research shows, the fact is that the state at the time had severe limitations to its resources and to its reach. And a lot of the kind of changes that it tried to enact were really limited by the varying local conditions across the country. So that's one of the key reasons, really, why it could never really successfully transform all the society. You know, it was very ambitious, but there was a basic limit in terms of resources and capacity.
Yes, very much so. You know, if you take the language reform, well, with the alphabet change, you know, moving from the Persian-based Ottoman alphabet to a Latin-based new Turkish alphabet in 1928. This was, I mean, the way it was implemented was in part, yes, people learning a new alphabet. Those who knew, those who were literate in Ottoman, now learning a new alphabet. But for the majority, it actually meant moving from illiteracy to literacy. For the first time, they were learning to read and write. And there was a major campaign, well, through multiple channels after 1928 to teach the new letters, but also to expand literacy throughout the country. And your point, the resources of the state, it was very, very uneven. So even with the Millet Mektep, the nation schools, this adult education program teaching literacy, well, it was not evenly distributed. And the same is true, of course, for the education system, the school system, that they were not evenly distributed across the country. So in generally, the cities and western parts of the country, there were more resources available, less so as you go into the east and southeast, into Anatolia and smaller communities. There were fewer resources available. And of course, a related issue is that in some regions, the state officials had less access to the local communities, especially when they did not speak the local language. That was a major problem. Or when local society was tribal society or otherwise strong, and the state had, state officials had very little presence or effect on local communities. So this is something I emphasize, the implementation efforts, but also the reception reaction. The process was very much uneven across the different regions and groups. I really wanted to draw attention to the complexity of the issue on the question of language and alphabet change. One factor that helped was that generally there was a positive attitude toward literacy and reading. Literacy and reading were seen as requirements of modernity, of part of being modern. And that really, I think, helped in the process of getting people to accept the new letters. And there, of course, the reforms were really experienced differently by different groups. In the case of language, so much depended on if a person was already literate or not, or it was a different experience for young people and elderly people. For those who were literate in Ottoman, some of them learned the new alphabet, some never did. So in 1928, some of the literate people essentially lost their functional literacy, and others, they learned the new alphabet, the new letters, but they continued to use the old letters. And there, it's really interesting to see how they often made a distinction between public and private sphere. And in the private sphere, they continued to write in Ottoman. In public sphere, sometimes they wrote in the new letters. But even in the public sphere, we see that, yes, sometimes years, decades later, they were still writing in Ottoman. So change is slow and gradual, even in an area, perhaps the most successful reform, one of the most successful reforms of the period, even in the case of the alphabet reform, change was, in a way, slower than we assumed it was.
And another important thing you mentioned in the book, I think that there was rather less resistance to the language reforms and to the transformation of the script, partly because illiteracy was so widespread before the old Ottoman script. It wasn't, not enough people knew it to really resist the new script being imposed. And the other crucial point is that the language transformation also kind of simplified the language, so it made it much easier to read and learn for people who may not have been literate before compared with the old Ottoman script.
That's definitely true. That was one of the main arguments they made, that the new alphabet was simpler, easier to learn, and easier to read and write. And also, it was more efficient for publishing. So there was almost a technical, mechanical side of it too, that the new alphabet was more efficient and cheaper for publication purposes. And of course, this really was part of it, these considerations, these practical considerations. But at the same time, yes, there was a cultural, ideological aspect of it too, that they really wanted to leave behind, the reformers really wanted to leave behind things closely associated with the Ottoman era and with the nation's, you know, Ottoman Islamic past. And they wanted to bring the nation closer to Europe, closer to the West. And in that way, too, the new alphabet, or adopting a Latin-based alphabet, made sense. Yet again, the generation, the people who were literate in Ottoman before 1928, they maintained that habit. It's hard to change established habits. Just to give one example, Orhan Veli Kanık, a great poet of the 20th century Turkey, in the 1940s, when he wrote poetry, it was always in Ottoman. In fact, some of his poets were recently published by Yapı Kredi Yayınları, and you can see that he was writing in poetry in Ottoman because that was the most natural thing for him to do. So we see this with other writers, politicians, historians, the late Ottoman historian Halil İnalcık. He acknowledged publicly that he sometimes still wrote in Ottoman in the 1990s, you know, after so many decades after the passage of the alphabet law. So I think these are very complex processes, and that we want to keep in mind, the experiences were so varied and uneven, depending on one's social background, the region, in this case, whether a person was literate or not prior to the change of the alphabet.
We spoke before about the hat law and the sartorial changes that were encouraged. One chapter in the book also talks about the regulation of women's clothing. And I wonder if you could just talk a bit about how a lot of the new reforms that were encouraged by the Republican regime built on trends that had already been in evidence towards the end of the Ottoman era, particularly, of course, with reference to veiling.
Yes, the changes in women's clothing that had started already in the late Ottoman period. So in the 1920s, 1930s, that change was encouraged by the state. There was no law in the case of women's clothing. There was no law similar to the hat law of 1925, but that didn't mean the state was not involved. So the historiography generally assumed, Turkish historiography generally assumed, that because there was no single law, the state kind of left it to the forces of modernization and fashion. What I discovered in my research is that there was disagreement when it came to women's clothing and efforts to modernize, to reform women's clothing. There was disagreement within the party. This can be seen clearly in party debates. some members of the party really wanted to push for radical reform, a law similar to the Hat Law for women as well. Others were more cautious, and there was fear. Clearly, there was fear of reaction, and that the RPP really did not want to face more opposition, more resistance due to a proposed law on women's clothing. And there, there was the whole experience of Afghanistan and Soviet Union in Central Asia, where the state, in the Soviet case, there were state-led efforts to forcefully change women's clothing. And that effort led to a lot of violence against women, especially in places like Uzbekistan. So in the Turkish case, the RPP government decided against passing a law and banning the peçe and çarşaf. The peçe was the face cover, the veil. So they never passed the law, but they delegated the responsibility for reforming women's clothing to the local authorities, to governors and kaymakams, district governors, local authorities, and to the press. And there, I've looked at records from the provinces. My research, there was an oral historical ethnographic aspect to my research. I conducted interviews with people who remembered the time of the reforms, who remembered the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. I also did, as a historian, I also did archival research in Ankara, the Prime Minister's Archive, and the Ministry of Interior Archives. And I was able to read many, many documents, many reports from throughout the country, from various provinces on all these reform issues, including women's clothing. And one word, one term I use is, or a couple of the terms, you know, the resistance and negotiation of the reforms. And in these reports from the provinces, we do see that there was a desire to maintain older forms of clothing, and people tried various methods, sending letters, sending petitions, asking governors, seeing the police, the gendarme, they should not be involved in clothing changes. But again, it's very very uneven process, that some segments of the society, women's clothing had already westernized, in others it hadn't. So how the people responded in part depended on their social status and their understandings of who they were, their identity, and how they approached what they understood of modernity, of being modern. That being modern was, it meant different things for different people. I interviewed a lot of elderly people, and I remember one person, one elderly man of peasant background from the Black Sea, he told me that shoes were one thing that brought modernity. So in his mind, kind of modernity was associated with shoes. So, modernity, does it mean modern clothes, European style clothes? Or did modernity mean an intervention of European ways of life? It all depended.
Now, your book raises a very interesting and important question, of this idea of like social engineering and the central state being used as a tool to try to transform society. And this belief in social engineering has been a kind of persistent theme throughout modern Turkish history up to today. Kind of shared by all ideologies, really, in the country. Whoever's in power sees it as their right and their duty to do this social engineering. And, of course, today we see the government particularly after the coup attempt last year, since then, using the education system, the changes there, and other tools to try and reshape society in this religious nationalist conservative image. And it may well be successful. Could you just comment a bit on this persistent theme throughout Turkish history?
Yes, this, of course, is not something unique to Turkey, that, 20th century, many states, especially modernizing states, have tried to use the power of the state to transform their societies. Again, Soviet Union is a great case of this. And in Turkey too, the state has tried to use the means available to it, the laws, legal system, the education system, the press, the media, to change, to transform the society, to transform the culture. In the Turkish case, one, again, because it's a modernizing state, and that there has been disagreement over what Turkish identity should really be and what should be the direction of the country. But those in power, also those who want to be in power, they all want to use the means available to the state to transform the society the way they imagine, they idealize Turkish society. And currently, it is very much contested. I would say, as a historian, it is too early. It is too early to say, what will come out of this process. Clearly, there are divisions within the society and this disagreement over what Turkish identity is about and what is the republic about. We are approaching the centennial of the republic, and of course it all change takes time. In the case of France and the French Revolution, it took a very long time for the French society, especially for French peasants, to really accept the revolution, accept the republic. Some would argue it was after World War I that finally French peasants came to terms with the republic. So I think in the Turkish case, it's a little early to say what will come out of it.
That was Hale Yilmaz. We were discussing her book, Becoming Turkish, Nationalist Reforms and Cultural Negotiations in Early Republican Turkey, 1923 to 1945, which is published by Syracuse University Press and forthcoming in Turkish from Istanbul Bilgi University Press later this year. You can read my review of the book at the Hürriyet Daily News. And if you're interested in this subject, I've also posted a couple of older pieces that you may be interested in. One is an interview that I did with academic Alexandros Lamprau back in 2015 about his book on the People's Houses, which operated for two decades after 1932 to spread the Kemalist reforms in towns across Turkey. And the other piece is an interview with the author Mahmut Makal, who I spoke to a few years ago about his very interesting time as a village teacher during the early Republican years. I put links to both of them at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and on the Turkey Book Talk Facebook page, so check them out there. Don't forget to rate or review the Turkey Book Talk podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast if you haven't already. Follow the Twitter account or like that Facebook page, or do both to stay updated with new episodes. Email recommendations, feedback or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And remember, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Özlem Beyarslan, Steve Bryant and Aaron Ataman. But until we meet again for the next episode, thank you once again for listening.
dinledir ama.